Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Spin Cycle Podcast. I'm your host, Kiara McKinney, and we have much to discuss today. First of all, Oscar nominations came out this week, and then we got a whole bunch of celebrity drama between Nicola Peltz and Brooklyn Beckham and the Beckham family, and more information about the Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni case. I haven't talked about that one very much, but I'm going to today because we have some new information that I think sheds light on the whole thing that I was kind of waiting for to speak on it. So let's get into it. I want to first start with the Brooklyn Beckham and Nicola Peltz drama because I have spoken about this one before. Basically, what happened this week was Brooklyn Beckham took to his Instagram story to post a series of statements that were scathing about his parents, saying that his parents have controlled the narrative and the press about their family and that they prioritize branding over family relationships. He says, quote, "For my entire life, my parents have controlled narratives and the press about our family. The performative social media posts, family events, and inauthentic relationships have been a fixture of the life I was born into." So some things to point out. Duh, I guess is what I'd say, because they're in the public eye. I don't really know what he would expect from parents who have lived such visible lives before they were together, when they got together, and after they've been together. They generate a lot of media attention. So you do have to think about the narratives about your family, and branding does matter when you're in the public eye. And I think that Brooklyn doesn't understand this because he's never had a fucking job. He also accused Victoria of bailing last minute on designing Nicola's wedding dress and hijacking his first dance with his wife to music by Marc Anthony. So let's talk about this a little bit. Brooklyn wrote that Victoria danced very inappropriately on me in front of everyone and that he never felt more uncomfortable in his entire life. The wedding DJ Fat did publicly back Brooklyn's account of this. Nicola liked his post, and a source told People that Victoria hijacked a special dance at the wedding when Marc Anthony performed as a gift to the family and referred to Victoria as the most beautiful woman in the room tonight. Which is not a nice thing to say at somebody else's wedding. So is all that over the top and ridiculous? Yes, absolutely. I'm not refuting any of that. My mother-in-law was 30 minutes late to my wedding, so I have thoughts about mother of the groom's behavior at weddings. I certainly have thoughts on that. But that's also kind of a universal experience. I don't really know that many people who've had great experiences with their mother-in-laws at their wedding, before the wedding, after the wedding, et cetera, et cetera. It's arguably the worst part of being engaged and getting married. So all that to say, I acknowledge that I'm sure Victoria was not necessarily on her best behavior. That being said, the wedding dress drama. There are three completely different versions of events here, okay? So we have Brooklyn's version as of this week, claiming that Victoria canceled making Nicola's dress in the 11th hour, despite how excited she was to wear her design, forcing her to urgently find a new dress. However, in 2022, Nicola told Variety, quote, "We connected to start designing the dress, and then a few days went by and I didn't hear anything. Victoria called my mom and said that her atelier couldn't make it. I was planning on wearing Victoria's wedding dress and I was truly so excited. She didn't say you can't wear it. I didn't say I didn't want to wear it." So then there's the timeline problem. Nicola and her stylist, Leslie Framar, told British Vogue they had a year's worth of conversations with Valentino's creative director, who took two trips to Rome, having two fittings in the United States, adding that it, quote, was the ultimate couture experience and that the dress was, quote, the culmination of a year's worth of conversations. And then Nicola called choosing Valentino a no-brainer. So it's not really possible to get a custom Valentino hot couture wedding gown in the 11th hour. Even though she has billionaire parents, that's still not really, like, realistic. And then a behind-the-scenes source in 2022 told Page Six, quote, "They can't stand each other and don't talk. The build-up to the wedding was horrendous. Nicola didn't want Victoria to be any part of the planning and wouldn't clue Victoria in on anything. Communication was minimal." So, lots of issues with this story. I think the biggest thing that stands out for me is that she wore custom Haute Couture Valentino and then is like, she backed out in the 11th hour. When really it sounds like they talked about it once and it never came to fruition. Neither of them ever followed up on it. That's what it sounds like to me. Two alphas colliding, recognizing that both of these women are high control women with carefully curated images and each surrounded by yes men who really fan the flames of this drama. Nicola is known to be difficult. She's an heiress to a billion-dollar MAGA fortune, and Victoria did not become Victoria Beckham by being laid back and chill. Ultimately, I do see this as just typical messy family dynamics playing out on a very public stage. And I think Brooklyn is too sheltered to understand just how commonplace all of this is. It reminds me a little bit of the Ashley Tisdale, Meghan Trainor mom group drama where I'm like, this is the most basic, common issue in the world. And the fact that y'all are making it like a week's worth of pop culture news cycle over it, I don't really understand. Let's talk a little bit more about Nicola and where she came from and like what this is all about. Nicola is the heir to Nelson Peltz's fortune. He's a billionaire investor and activist. He co-founded the investment fund Trian Partners. He is a stakeholder in major companies like Wendy's and Cisco. So they're an old money dynasty whose family began in wholesale food distribution businesses, going back to the Cisco of it all. He also invests in major corporations like P&G, PepsiCo. And he has served as a non-executive chairman for companies like the Madison Square Garden Company. He's also a known Republican donor. And as of recently, he's still associated with conservative political funding. He's a major Trump donor who actually allegedly played matchmaker between Trump and Elon. So that's where she comes from. And then in 2009, the blog Gawker, RIP Gawker, thanks Peter Thiel, posted claims that Nicola, who was 14 at the time, relentlessly bullied her nannies, butlers, and other staff. There were rumors that she pushed her nanny down the stairs. A former hairstylist of hers named Justin Anderson, who worked with her during a 2014 press tour, commented on Instagram calling her, quote, "one of the worst celebs I've ever worked with and a bad apple." He worked with Peltz in her early career during the Transformers Age of Extinction press tour, and she's 18, 19 years old. Yes, Nicola purports herself to be an actress. More than Brooklyn does, that's for goddamn sure. But the professional relationship between Anderson and Peltz was short-lived and did not continue beyond that period. According to a source, he was replaced after allegedly leaving her hair, quote, "burnt off" following a bleach and dye job. During a 2019 interview, Anderson referred to her as, quote, "the new Transformers girl from a very wealthy family" and called her a monster. And then in recent stories on Instagram, he said that she had a, quote, "spooky energy" and claimed that when somebody's just not nice, it always comes out. Then there was the wedding planner drama, which I believe I've talked about before. She had three sets of planners come through amongst the months planning for their wedding. The first planner quit just 6 weeks before the wedding, and then the second team lasted only 9 days. Nelson Peltz ended up filing a lawsuit against the second planners for allegedly refusing to refund the $159,000 deposit after they were fired. And in court filings, text messages showed Nicola frustrated with the guest list errors, texting, "I'm tired of catching mistakes on this RSVP list, honestly, and this is not what I asked for." Court documents revealed that Claudia Peltz mentioned Nelson could not know the cost of hair and makeup over $100,000 or he would kill her and be so mad. It's worth noting that the Peltzes are worth more than double the Beckhams. So here comes my theory, which is that Brooklyn is purporting that he's doing this for freedom from his overbearing parents who just try to curate an image. But I mean, realistically, Brooklyn has attempted to have a career doing photography or modeling or cooking, but none of them have taken off. He has no career. He is simply David and Victoria Beckham's son and Nicola Peltz's husband. The Beckhams' reported combined wealth is a $637 million, whereas Nelson Peltz is worth $1.6 billion. Nelson has purchased several properties in L.A. for Brooklyn and Nicola, including a $14.7 million mansion in Beverly Hills. The Peltz family spent around $4 million on the wedding, and Brooklyn now lives fully funded by his father-in-law while pursuing further vanity projects. So, like I said, Brooklyn frames this as escaping control and choosing independence, but he's never had to work a single day in his life. He's just trading in his parents' expectations and wallet for his in-laws' bankroll bag with fewer strings attached. And he's swapping one form of financial dependency for another, just with a bigger trust fund and lower expectations. Now, let's talk about the stupid It Ends With Us lawsuit. I mean, this whole thing is such a mess, and this movie never should have gotten made in the first place because it's a shitty book. Colleen Hoover is a terrible author, and I'm sorry for saying that because she's currently battling cancer, and so I do feel sorry insulting her livelihood. However, it's the truth. Okay, so here's a quick overview of like where things stand with the It Ends With Us lawsuits in case you have not been following. The core dispute is that Blake Lively accused Justin Baldoni and his company Wayfarer Studios of orchestrating a smear campaign against her after she spoke out about an allegedly toxic work environment on the set of the film, which debuted in 2024. Blake initially filed a complaint with the California Civil Rights Department on December 20th, 2024, accusing Baldoni of sexual harassment and retaliation, and then filed a federal civil lawsuit against him on December 31st, 2024. Baldoni and his associates filed a $400 million lawsuit against Lively, Ryan Reynolds, and their publicists in January 2025, alleging extortion, defamation, and invasion of privacy. However, in 2025, a U.S. judge dismissed Baldoni's defamation lawsuit, ruling that statements made during legal proceedings cannot form the basis of a defamation claim. So the current status basically is that Blake's lawsuit against Justin and his other associates are set for trial this summer. And this week, there was a summary judgment hearing, which caused exhibits to be unsealed on January 20th, including text conversations. Which is what I am about to get into here. Essentially, Justin's legal team is trying to get Lively's case dismissed, while Lively's team insists that they deserve their day in court. So, let's talk about it. Some of the text messages are very eye-opening. I didn't really expect them to be this interesting, to be honest. When they were released, I was like, okay, who cares? And then I saw more of the context and I was like, okay, this is a little bit nuts. So Taylor Swift had texted Blake about how including her, meaning Taylor's, music in the trailer would give Lively, quote, more power over the film. Basically kind of saying that Justin made a mistake by allowing them to use the Taylor song because it, you know, connected it, I guess, more to Blake than to Justin. Saying that I'm your ally, not his. Blake also told Matt Damon and Ben Affleck that she rewrote the entire script and directed every actor. The president of Sony told Blake that Justin's cut tested better with audiences, but Blake responded she was still going, quote, full steam ahead with my cut. So this really illustrates to me that the more famous person here, meaning Blake Lively, attempted to lead a mutiny against the smaller independent artists, meaning Justin Baldoni, and ultimately try to steamroll him into creating a version of the movie she wanted, despite being hired as an actress, not the director. And then there was this Aladdin gift. So I'm going to read you this Reddit thread because it helps illustrate it better than I could. It says, text messages between Lively and Swift dated April 12, 2023 show that Lively used an animated GIF of the Disney character Aladdin to refer to Justin Baldoni. That specific Aladdin GIF doesn't have any well-known meaning in pop culture or meme culture, so it seems likely that it was an inside reference between the two of them. This also makes sense because Baldoni is the person they are talking about in the text messages right before and right after the GIF. Because these texts are from so early on, they raise an uncomfortable question. Why use Aladdin to represent Baldoni? Is it possible that Lively and Swift saw Aladdin as a funny or fitting image because they vaguely associate Baldoni with a Middle Eastern character? If so, it suggests that bias or racialized thinking may already have been present in how Lively privately talked about Baldoni at that early stage. And again, this is on Reddit. It's on the R It Ends With Lawsuits subreddit, which I do not frequent, but based on this, I'm kind of interested. So someone commented, the top comment underneath it says, Blake Lively is racist as fuck, and it absolutely played a role in how she viewed Jamie Heath and Justin Baldoni, two men of color that were beneath her. I guess it's worth noting that she and Ryan Reynolds did get married on a plantation, which is, you know, questionable behavior, but I think she has any other outward accusations of racism. So, and this other person says he's half Jewish and half Italian. To staunch racists, he wouldn't be considered white. To normal people, he is. And somebody responds, thank you for explaining this. I was literally thinking, isn't Baldoni white? So, I mean, I don't know. Take that how you will. I think this is somewhat debatable in that, sure, I guess he does kind of look like Aladdin, but I think that's a compliment. But it's also, I see how it's racist in that you're like, you're making fun of him for looking ethnic, I think, in that context. That's the way I'm taking it anyway. So I didn't like that. And then within the text messages, you can see that Blake blatantly asks Taylor to vouch for her version of the script, but tells her, you don't have to read it, of course. Taylor responds saying, I'll do anything for you. So it directly contradicts her public stance on artists owning their own work and having creative control. After going on a whole crusade about owning her own masters to the point where not only did she purchase her own masters back, but she also re-recorded them to devalue them before buying them back. So she goes on this whole like artist crusade about owning the rights and blah, blah, blah. But then Justin Baldoni, who optioned the rights to this book, owns a production company and is trying to like make this quote unquote independent film. She has no problem sabotaging him for her more famous friend. Justin wrote in text that Blake had threatened not to promote the movie if she wasn't allowed her preferred edit. And he said in these texts, quote, she had the nuclear bomb. If she doesn't promote the movie, she can leak that I'm a bad person or that she felt unsafe with me. And a Sony executive confirmed that they did receive complaints from cast members, but stated that they were more about how the set was run and Justin's inexperience in running a set rather than something that required HR involvement. So all this to say, while I don't necessarily see Justin Baldoni as a perfect victim in this, I definitely see this as kind of a David and Goliath situation where Blake Lively has this famous husband, all these famous friends, and she called in all these reinforcements to overtake this, you know, kind of like up and coming artist, this director, producer who's trying to make this film that highlights domestic violence. He's a self-proclaimed feminist. And while Jenny Slate said in some of her text messages that were unsealed that he was faking all that, maybe that's true. You know, like it's definitely possible. But from the outside, just purely talking about optics, it does not make Blake Lively look good. And it also doesn't bode well for Ryan Reynolds. And it also doesn't bode well for Taylor Swift. Lastly, we got to talk about Oscar nominations, which just came out this week. They take place on Sunday, March 15th. Some pretty notable stuff came out of these nominations. So first of all, Sinners becomes the most nominated movie of all time. They received a record 16 Oscar nominations, surpassing the previous 14 nomination mark set by All About Eve and La La Land. Literally surpassing Titanic is an insane stat. The film received nods for Best Picture, Best Director for Ryan Coogler, Best Actor for Michael B. Jordan. Wonmi Mosaku, I hope I said that right. She's beautiful. She plays, I believe it's Smoke's wife in the film. They also were nominated for several technical categories. Timothy Chalamet became the youngest actor since Marlon Brando with 3 Oscar nominations at 30 years old. He's also the youngest actor to be nominated for producing and acting in the same year. His portrayal of Marty Moser in Marty Supreme landed him his 3rd Best Actor nomination. Some other notable call-outs. Ruth E. Carter became the most nominated Black woman in Oscars history with her 5th nomination for Sinners Design. Delroy Lindo scored his 1st Oscar nomination at age 73 for Best Supporting Actor in Sinners. Stellan Skarsgård, my king, became the 1st actor nominated for Best Supporting Actor for a non-English language film for sentimental value. Steven Spielberg earned his 14th Best Picture nomination as a producer on Hamnet, a record for an individual producer. F1 surprisingly scored a Best Picture nomination despite mixed feedback from its release. And lastly, Wicked for Good was completely shut out despite the original receiving 10 nominations, winning 2. So I guess Nikki Glaser's Golden Globes joke about it being Wicked for money was right on the money. All right, guys, that's it for this week. Thank you for tuning in. If you've noticed, I released this last podcast on like a Thursday or Friday, and I don't know when this one's coming this week. I think I'm just going to drop them when I feel like it because I don't have enough listeners to really stick to a schedule. And this is who I am now. But thank you for tuning in. Follow me on Substack. Follow me on Instagram. I'm Get the Spin Cycle anywhere. Love you so much. Talk to you next week. Bye.